From Tuktoyaktuk to St. John's, from Seoul to Rio, Shanghai, and Bombay, the information superhighway is supposed to be our route into the future. We know computers and the 500-channel universe are about entertainment and money, but they're also about civil society and human rights. The heart of democracy is an informed public. Armed with information, people are able to chart their way into the future. That's what we believe. And the revolution in information, we are told, will empower people everywhere.
He served loyally for 8 years. Bush said he's ready to do more to protect the nation's land, air, and water.
1988, in a sense, is the year that the earth spoke back. Our land, water, and soil support a remarkable range of human activities, but they can only take so much. And we must remember to treat them not as given, but as a gift. I'm an environmentalist.
One of the reasons that the environment was a big topic on television and all the other media 10 years ago was that information about the trouble it was in had reached a large number of people. And that information, as we expected, turned into civic and political action. This concern for the quality of our air, water, and food built steadily ever since 1962, when Rachel Carson published her pioneering book, Silent Spring. 30 years later, in 1992, the largest gathering of heads of state ever in human history met in Rio for the Earth Summit.
Brian Mulroney and an unprecedented collection of more than 110 other world leaders lined up at the microphone today at the Earth Summit in Rio.
Sustainable development became a rallying cry as politicians and business leaders promised to take a new path.
The nations gathered here today have the human genius to create a world free from deprivation and secure from degradation.
Henceforth, they said, the environment would be weighed in every political, social, and economic decision.
Peace and development and the protection of a very fragile and challenged human environment.
Yet 2 weeks after Rio, the group of seven industrialized nations met in Munich, and not a word came up about the environment. They talked about the new global economy to be fueled by the information revolution. And ever since, media pundits have pronounced the economy as our main priority, while the environment is said to have fallen off the list of major problems. So what has happened since? Have the problems discussed at the Rio summit gone away? Did our informed interest and demands for action start us all on a road to recovery? Or could it be that having enormous amounts of information doesn't always mean that we're really informed? In 1996, Oprah Winfrey did a show about whether prime U.S. beef was safe. Her guest was Howard Lyman. He's an ex-cattle rancher who talked about how feeding animal parts to cows could bring mad cow disease to North America.
Remember, today, the United States, 14% of all cows by volume are ground up, turned into feed, and fed back to other animals.
But cows are herbivores. They shouldn't be eating other cows.
That's exactly right. And what we should be doing is exactly what nature says. We should have them eating grass, not other cows. We've not only turned them into carnivores,
cannibals. Let me just ask you this right now, Howard. How do you know for sure that the cows are ground up and fed back to the other cows?
Oh, I've seen it. These are USDA statistics. They're not something that we're making up. Right now, remember...
Now, doesn't that concern y'all a little bit right here, hearing that? It has just stopped me cold from eating another burger. I'm stopped, but...
It was great television. But the next thing she knew, the Cattlemen's Association was suing both Oprah Winfrey and Howard Lyman. They claimed $20 million under a new state law which prohibits you from making disparaging remarks about food. In January 1998, the case went to trial in Texas. It lasted 2 weeks, and every day there was a media circus around the courthouse. In the end, Oprah won.
It has been so stressful and removed people from their families. And some days I didn't know how I was going to get through it, sitting in the courtroom, especially the days that I was on the witness stand and then having to go do sometimes two shows an evening. And I'm still off hamburgers.
Without people like Oprah Winfrey and Howard Lyman willing to take the chance of being sued, it's debatable whether the public would ever have heard about this particular story. It's really important that we know what's going on around us. It's the basis, in a free society, for being able to form opinions about issues and act on them. In fact, it's an axiom that the entire concept of a democratic government is impossible without a free press. The accepted wisdom is that the more kinds of media we have, the better for society. We now have the 500-channel universe and the Internet. The hype is that with access to all this information, we've got more power to control our lives. Lawrence Grossman has been president of NBC News and president of PBS. He's thought a lot about the nature of information and public discourse.
Most people get most of their information now in the United States from local television newscasts. And local television newscasts, as every study has shown, are filled with nothing but crime and happy talk and sports and weather and very little else. So that while there's a great opportunity for an informed public to act in their own interest, there are real questions as to whether we're really getting an informed public. And while everybody talks about this great new age as the information age, what we're really seeing is not the information age coming upon us as much as the entertainment age.
Does this mean that people are no longer interested in important public issues? Or are they not getting the information they need?
There's a great tendency to blame the people. Why aren't they interested in things that affect their own lives? And at the same time, we're not doing anything about encouraging that interest, stimulating that interest, or providing what's necessary to make sure that they get well informed. And the one thing we know about in a democracy is that we cannot just leave it to chance. And it's certainly unwise to leave it to a media that is so totally dominated by entertainment, amusement, diversion, and the need for profits.
The information revolution is not just about television. It's computers, the Internet, and global communications. In theory, we have more information available than ever before. Lawrence Grossman.
The interesting thing is we are moving hell-bent into this second era of electronic communications, the telecommunications era, the rise of the Internet, the convergence of the satellite and computers and television and telephone. And that race is being entirely driven by and won by commercial interests, understandably. There's a huge amount of money to be made. But the money lies in what? In entertainment, in sports, in commercial data distribution. The marketplace fails in certain areas, not those areas, but in areas like providing fair-minded, intelligent, full civic information. And so I think we need a new paradigm, a new model, a new set of public policies as we move into the digital telecommunications age to provide the kinds of material that society values and needs for its survival, and especially democracy requires, but that the marketplace, understandably and for very good reason, is not providing.
Neil Postman is an eminent media analyst. He's a professor at New York University and author of many books, including the groundbreaking bestseller, Amusing Ourselves to Death. Postman calls television the command center of our culture.
Television is an awesome technology, and because that is so, we have a special obligation to study it very carefully to figure out what it really does best. And I have no objection to ice hockey being shown on television. Television is terrific for that, and certainly is for football games, and for maybe certain forms of popular literature like soap operas and so on. So there are lots of things television is good for. What it is not good for, complex discourse about politics, about education, about religion, about news, and so on. And the problem here in the States with television is that television has become the command center of the culture, almost the equivalent of the church in the medieval world. For anything to matter, then it had to come through the church. And in America today, for anything to matter, it's got to be on television. We go to television for everything: our news, our commerce, our politics, our religion, our education, and so on. Now, it's at that point that I become the naysayer. I say, this is not a medium that can present to us in forms that are intelligible and serious the ideas that every culture needs to have. People watch television. And that has to be said over and over again, the verb there. People watch it. And what they like to watch are fast-moving, exciting, exotic images. And that's what television is mainly good for. So it begins to become dangerous when people look to television for their serious ideas and information about the world.
When we turn on the news at night, we assume that what we see reflects reality, when in fact, television creates reality. It's a reality that consists of pictures. The more dramatic, the better.
I mean, what is the first question a news director asks when he comes to work? Do we have any good film footage? And if someone says, oh, we've got something great, this guy in Oklahoma City committed suicide, he jumped off a building, and someone got a videotape of him going all the way down, it's great. Well, you know, say, well, that's our lead. That's our opener tonight, and we'll use it in the promo at 5 o'clock. Say, tune in at 6 tonight. Live footage of a man committing suicide in Oklahoma City. So what's happening there is that the television director knows what television is good for. The director knows that people watch television. Now, if someone says, yeah, well, the Congress passed the budget today. So, crying out loud, what are we going to show there? What is it to watch? Well, we have to mention it. But does someone have a picture of the budget? Well, what is the budget? You know, it's a 1,000-page document. Well, let's show a picture of it. And then we'll do, a 20-second discourse about it. Television is at its best when it's doing what we might roughly call entertainment. When we come to serious matters, television is not a medium that's very good for this, especially matters that require talk, that require language and complex language. And matters that require some historical perspective.
As biological beings, we evolved sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, that inform us about the physical world around us. So what we see, hear, or smell is important for our survival. But information that comes to our senses today is fundamentally different. Rather than moving us to action, it pacifies us. Neil Postman.
99% of what passes for news on television is of a nature that the average person can do nothing about it. about the only thing I find that I can do something about on the news is the weather. So that if I know this is going to rain tomorrow, I can prepare with an umbrella the next day. There was a time when the purpose of information was to solve specific problems in either the physical or symbolic environment. People sought information because they needed it to do something in the world. Now, beginning in the 1840s with telegraphy and photography, because this is not just a television matter, we've become inundated with information from all over. So that most of the information, it's input, but there's no output on our part. There's nothing we can do. I mean, we now can watch a murder or a story about a murder on television or something just as lurid and awful and continue to eat our chicken sandwich. We don't even get upset by it. There's nothing, in any case, we're not invited to do anything here. It's hard to prove this. But this may have created a sense of impotence that people have in the world. After all, if you're constantly getting information about which you can do nothing or very little, it tends to suggest that you're a rather impotent person. I mean, I have no plans to do anything about the troubles in Northern Ireland or the troubles in the Middle East. Maybe this accounts in some part for a surprising indifference that many people have toward toxicity in the physical environment. No one may wonder, well, wouldn't people be interested in global warming or in what's happening to the rainforest? I mean, what could be more interesting? But it's possible that we've simply been conditioned to think, in a sense, that information has nothing to do with us. It's just a kind of commodity.
The media, newspapers, books, radio, television, the net, flood us with information. But is it too much of a good thing? David Schenck is a young computer enthusiast who reveled in the opening of the information superhighway. He's still enthusiastic, but now, after 10 years of surfing the net, he's starting to have second thoughts. He wrote about them in a bestseller called Data Smog.
Information technology is said to make our lives more efficient, entertaining, to bring people closer together, to make businesses work better with fewer people so the productivity is higher and the profits are higher. It's said to make us more educated because it provides us more information faster. It's said to improve our health because it aids biological and other types of scientific research. And the sense of the people who are at the really extreme optimistic end of this spectrum about technology think that it's technology that makes our lives better, and it's technology that's primarily responsible for what we know as progress. I've written this book to discuss some of the unintended consequences and unwanted side effects of information technology, which I think, you know, we all have to pay attention to, whether we're sanguine or not about the information revolution.
There is no way we can avoid the benefits and the downsides of this revolution, whether in the use of automated bank tellers, credit cards, or plane reservations. Within my own lifetime, I've had to adjust to a lot of changes. Society has undergone a series of revolutions, from radio to television, satellites, and computers. Each innovation has transformed the way we perceive the world and the way we behave. People are impressed by the sheer volume of information computers can store. But it needs a human brain to sort through it all, to interpret the information and give it meaning.
Information is a resource. It is something that we all need. But there is a point beyond which the speed of information and even the amount of information starts to diminish the quality of our lives. We certainly want to become educated, and we want to continue to educate ourselves and always get more and more information and learn more and more. But we need to distinguish between information and knowledge. And the point is always converting that raw data or that information into knowledge and wisdom. And I think we live in an age now where it's very easy to get caught up in the thrill of getting the information and forget that it's all about taking that information and turning it into something interesting inside your brain.
As a university professor, I'm often approached by students who ask for my opinion on a report on UFOs, astrology, or cures for baldness. But when I ask them where they learned about it, the answer is often, "Oh, I saw it on TV," or "I read it somewhere." But it makes a huge difference whether it was on The Nature of Things or Jerry Springer, whether it was written up in the National Enquirer or Scientific American. When we can't remember the source of our information, we're in bad shape. It's validated simply because it exists. And believe me, you can find information supporting any nutty idea you want, from a flat earth to computer implants in our brains by extraterrestrials. To make things even worse, with all of this information, the clamor for our attention grows steadily more strident and outrageous. David Schenck.
Technology is overcoming so many of our obstacles in life that we're quickly finding that one of the few limited resources left in our lives is our attention span. We're always going to need a certain amount of sleep and spend a certain amount of time eating and spending time with our families and friends. And we're only going to have so much attention each day for information, for data, for stimulus. And what we find is that more and more people are competing for that limited amount of attention. There are more channels on TV, there are more channels on radio. In a way, there are millions of channels now on the internet. Advertising and electronic media is creeping into virtually every space in our lives. And one of the things I propose in my book is that there's kind of a vicious spiral that results from this, in that the more people there are who are competing for our attention, the more outrageous things they have to do to get our attention. And so the neon signs become bigger, and the ads and television become louder and more shocking and more vulgar, and so do the shows between the ads. But I think we need to realize that really this is a function of being in a society that's glutted with information, and where the people who produce the media feel like they need to do anything they possibly can to get our attention.
When I still worked in the lab as a full-time scientist, I'd wake up in the morning thinking about some idea in research, then go to work and think and read and talk only about that idea, then go back to the lab at night to keep working on it, and this would go on for days and weeks. It was the most exhilarating, creative time of my life. But today, I find that my time is fragmented by more and more demands, faxes, voicemail, email, and letters, plus the insistent pull of television, newspapers, and radio, not to mention my family and friends. David Schenck.
When we get distracted, that's when we're very vulnerable. Not only do our lives start to lose some of the quality, you know, we can't concentrate as well, and we don't communicate as well, and so forth. We have a general kind of feeling of angst or, you know, anxiety, malaise, just from being distracted. But we also, we become extremely vulnerable to any kind of marketing message, whether it's political or commercial claims. And the problem is, as information speeds up, as we become more distracted, it becomes more and more difficult to think skeptically. We tend to accept things much less critically. And I think that is really a terrible thing, not just for consumers, but for society. I think we all want, even marketers ultimately want a society where people are more discerning, more educated, are thinking more critically about how they apply everything to their lives and their lifestyles.
We live in a world of information and communication. Yet it's increasingly difficult to mobilize public concern and action. For years, environmentalists were enormously successful at getting their message out. It may be more than a coincidence that the environment dropped out of sight at the same time that television exploded into a multi-channel universe. But whatever the reason, serious stories about the environment have become more scarce. Elizabeth May is a longtime environmental activist. She's currently the executive director of the Sierra Club of Canada.
The evening news is predictably plane train crashes or murders or political scandal shenanigans, but it's not about 30,000 children died today because they lack clean drinking water. Because that happens every day, so it's not news. It's not about the retreat of glaciers because the climate is changing so dramatically and fundamentally that we no longer can predict anything. And when you watch the way climate change has dominated the news, it's never treated as climate change dominating the news. There's floods in China, there's fires burning out of control in Florida, there seem to be, you know, people dying in a massive heat wave in Texas. But generally speaking, those stories aren't treated as one compelling story of human behavior is changing the climate in the world we live in.
For a long time, physiologists have known about an interesting phenomenon about our nerves. When a nerve is stimulated, it gives a response. But if it's repeatedly stimulated, the response gradually dies down and then stops. This is called habituation. You notice it if a bell goes off. You may be alarmed at first, but very soon, if the ringing continues, you hardly notice it. In many ways, that's our response to the stories that do come out about the environment. Many problems, like global warming, are what I call slow-motion catastrophes. We don't see blood and people dying right away, so after a while, people, including those in the media, become habituated to the warnings. In order to get attention, environmentalists need ever more spectacular stunts.
Saboteurs struck twice during the weekend at two Icelandic whaling boats and Iceland's only whaling processing plant. The ships were scuttled while tied up in the port of Reykjavik. The computer system and the machinery in the plant used to process whale byproducts were destroyed. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society says it carried out the attacks on the ships.
The Canadian leader of the environmentalist group, Paul Watson, says the ships were sunk because...
Paul Watson is arguably the most radical of environmentalists. He was a founding member of Greenpeace, but broke off to form the Sea Shepherd Society 20 years ago. This is an organization dedicated to the protection of marine mammals. Watson is probably best known for leading the resistance to the slaughter of baby seals in Quebec and Newfoundland. More recently, he sank the entire Icelandic whaling fleet, for which he was put in prison. He's out just now, and he claims he does these things not because he's angry, but because of the way our media culture has developed. Paul Watson.
Last week I was speaking with the foreign editor for the Los Angeles Times because they had a public relations puff piece on the whaling industry showing how people weren't protesting whaling anymore and maybe people were accepting the fact that whaling was going to be resurrected. And I called him up and I said, that's absolutely ridiculous. People aren't supportive of whaling. And his answer to me, I think, was really very telling about how the media views these things. He says, well, you'll just have to go out and sink another whaling boat, won't you? In other words, that's the only thing they're going to pay attention to. People wonder why we sink whaling boats. Well, he answered the question, because they're not going to give you the time of day if you're there trying to talk about something based on giving people information and statistics or whatever. They're only interested in dramatics. Unfortunately, the media is only interested in four elements in every story, and that's sex, scandal, violence, and celebrity. No story is a story unless it has one of those elements. And if you have all four elements, you have a super story. Sometimes stories you can't seem to get rid of. And for this reason, you really have to understand what the media culture is all about. When I did a campaign against aerial shooting of wolves in British Columbia in 1984, we had a story that carried the headlines across Canada for 2 weeks, and the reason being is that we had a story with all four elements, the sex, scandal, violence, and celebrity. We had the violence of them shooting the wolves. We had the violence of their threats against us. We had the scandal of an environment minister taking a bribe from a big game hunting organization in return for giving them what they wanted. And to round that all up, I simply recruited Bo Derek as our spokesperson on that. And I remember at the press conference, a reporter saying to me, oh, come on now, what's Bo Derek know about wolves? I mean, what do you have her here for? I mean, she's an actress, for God's sakes. And I said, yes, you make the rules and we play the game. You must have just graduated from journalism school or something, because if I had the best wolf biologist in the world and called this press conference, it'd be an empty room. But because Bo Derek is our spokesperson, it'll be the headline of your newspaper tomorrow, and there's nothing you can do about it.
People like Paul Watson are still able to get their stories out. But few environmental groups have Watson's flair for drama to attract media attention. And Elizabeth May thinks there's even more to it than that.
Public outrage takes energy. Nobody has energy for outrage when you're trying to raise kids, hold down a job, pay your mortgage, right? So the strain of maintaining that extra thing in your life of wondering, when is the government going to do something to protect us from pesticides, radioactive fallout, whatever the issue is of that generation? When is the government going to do something? When the government says, we've heard you. And also, a very, very clever government and industry and corporate approach to public outrage, which is to say, uncle, we hear you. We're all so sorry. Mea culpa, we're all going to be environmentalists. We're all environmentalists together. They wanted to, you know, there's no difference between, you know, Sierra Club and Monsanto. We're all just so concerned about the environment. We are parents too, after all. And in the 70s, the response was, we are now creating departments of the environment. They were created in Canada 1970, 72, all the other countries around the time of Stockholm did. For the Earth Summit, we've heard you. We now have global conventions to protect all life on Earth through biodiversity convention. We're going to protect the climate from the disruptive impacts of all this air pollution. We are committed to stabilizing carbon dioxide emissions. All of this nonsense. And what happened was, it's a very good way to shut down public outrage, is to say, we've dealt with it. We're on top of it now. And for a lot of Canadians, they thought, right, now I've got my blue box, and everybody's an environmentalist, and we're all agreeing, we're all on the same side. So when the public goes back to thinking, right, I still care about the environment, it's not that they don't care, but they believe something's being done, so they can turn their attention elsewhere. At the same time that that happens, that wouldn't work if the media stayed on the case, saying, right, the government's committed to this, they say they've done a climate change convention, they're going to take action, let's see what happens when the rubber hits the road. Let's watch what's going on here.
A lot of the information we receive in our daily lives comes from the public relations industry. Their work is not just about selling cars and deodorants. PR firms construct corporate images. They also help their clients work out a response to environmental pressure. Josh Carliner is head of TRAC, the Transnational Resource and Action Center in San Francisco. He's also author of a recent book, The Corporate Planet. He thinks that these PR firms went into high gear when environmentalists started to threaten the way their clients do business.
One of the things that the public relations industry has done is it's counseled its corporate clients on how to deal with the environmental movement. The environmental movement has put tremendous amount of pressure on the corporate world. It has cost them billions of dollars. It's forced them to change some of what they produce and how they produce it. And the potential that the environmental movement has is to foster even more thoroughgoing change. So the public relations counselors of companies like Burst & Marsteller or the other big ones, and there's a dozen or so of these big global public relations corporations, have counseled them to sit down at the table and make friends with the environmentalists and promote a joint approach to solving some of these problems. So starting in the 1980s, these corporations began to pour hundreds of thousands of dollars into the environmental movement. They started making donations to some of the big environmental organizations in the United States. And surprise, surprise, a lot of these groups not only took the money, but often became quite quiet on some of the issues involving these corporations. Some of them began to send representatives to sit on the boards of directors of these environmental groups. And so now you see often when there's a big environmental problem, the corporations and the government and the environmental groups will all sit down at a table together and try to work it out.
It was called cooperation, not confrontation. And it seemed to augur a new age of harmony, with responsible corporations working out compromises with sophisticated and economically realistic environmentalists.
For instance, there was this thing called the President's Council for Sustainable Development. Some of the big corporations like Georgia-Pacific and Dow Chemical and Chevron Oil all sat on this President's Council with some of the big environmental groups like the National Wildlife Federation and the Natural Resource Defense Council and Sierra Club and others, along with government officials. And the 104th Congress comes about, led by Newt Gingrich, and all these same corporations that are sitting at the President's table talking about sustainable development are lobbying the halls of Congress to gut the environmental regulations of the United States. And when this happened, some of the environmental groups kind of woke up and said, well, maybe these guys aren't our friends after all. But this problem still exists.
All over the world, the public relations strategy is to bring together stakeholders, corporations, environmental groups, government. They're supposed to work out compromises. Josh Carliner says it usually means environmentalists are co-opted to support industry agendas. And it's not just about co-option. It's about dividing and conquering.
It's a strategy to basically go after the most mainstream groups, try to befriend them, buy them, co-opt them, and therefore marginalize some of the most progressive elements of the environmental movement, basically to divide and conquer the environmental movement and make the progressive groups look extreme, when in fact what the progressive groups are looking at are some of the root causes of the problems and the need for fundamental change to solve them.
There's a deliberate attempt being made to undermine the credibility of environmental groups and to question their motives. It's called brownwashing. At the same time, public relations firms are being paid billions of dollars to portray corporations as responsible and environmentally sensitive. That's called greenwashing. In some cases, PR firms help industries set up organizations that sound environmental, but in fact support the corporate agenda. We're being flooded with green information. How's the average person supposed to know who to believe?
I think the good news is that there's a very vibrant environmental movement out there. There's a lot of really good groups doing really good work, both at the grassroots and even at the national level as well. We just have to be as careful to select the groups we support as to understand the corporations that we don't want to support. In other words, we need to be skeptical of the corporate greenwash advertising that we see happening all around us all the time. And we also need to question who these environmental organizations are and use some criteria to choose to participate in or support those.
Today, we're in the middle of an information revolution. But along with useful information comes trivia, disinformation, and info glut. We need information to make informed decisions about our lives. One of the places we've always looked to for that information is the past. But as information explodes around us, it distracts us and takes up every available moment. Todd Gitlin is a professor of culture, journalism, and sociology at New York University.
The phrase used in America to be synonymous with you don't matter or you're irrelevant is your history. What we have in the new technologies, and here I'm including not just television and cable and email and internet, but also video games and computer games, what we see in all these forms are the elaboration of the means by which to live in the present with a sense that whatever happened more than a week and a half ago is irrelevant. People have liked the idea of living in the present and the pleasures of living in the present. So that's not new. What is new is that people have the means, not just the desire, but the means to live in the present. And, you know, the present is always leaping up at you, and it's so rich in a way. I mean, it's here, listen to me, buy me, watch me, communicate with me. And that fills up the present. You fill up the present that densely and that rewardingly, and necessarily you help the past recede, and the future seems impenetrable.
Without a past or future, we have no context to make sense of all the information that's coming at us. Some people think that more information will help us be better citizens and lead to greater democracy. But a world of information with no rules or ethical boundaries is a chaotic, terrifying land where anything goes.
This is one of the curious challenges to democracy that's posed for this, because democratic citizenry in classic theory had to be informed not simply horizontally, that is, by people chatting with each other in sharing their ignorance, but on the foundation of a certain educated appraisal of what information is valuable and what is not, and how to understand information and how to weigh it and so on. And this means that education is indispensable. Simply to have people, you know, barking at each other across the web is nothing more than expediting the communication of rumor and badness, as in the child's game of telephone, you know, where you sit in a circle and start a rumor, and by the time it gets around, you discover that it's very different than what you whispered in the first place. It's been garbled along the way. The question is, and this is, I think, a profound question for modern societies, what is the foundation of authority that conveys to people a sense of what it is worth knowing and how to evaluate what comes across? What's a legitimate authority? And I can't give you a generic answer. I can just say that it's the fundamental challenge to education. And I mean education here in the larger sense, not just educational institutions, but the culture as a whole, to convey a sense of what is more valuable, of what is more thoughtful, of what is more rational, of what is more democratic, etc., than other things. And the crisis of all our institutions, I think, media, politics, religion, is the loss of faith in the capacity or even the desirability of the standard keepers to convey to the young what it is they ought to know. I think that there's a tremendous doubt. The problem is we're operating with, in a certain way, an early 21st century understanding, but with 19th century or 18th century institutions.
You know, I often think if a Martian came to this planet and decided to find out what we humans are about by tuning into TV newscasts, he'd quickly decide we're obsessed with sex, violence, and money. We're flooded with commercials and stories about celebrities. It wouldn't appear we're at all interested in important issues like justice, environmental protection, or peace. Todd Gitlin.
What you say about the media is true in spades of the internet and all the other new technologies, too. That is, our Martian would not get a very benign sense of the capacity of people to govern themselves by looking at what's floating around the internet on these subjects. But at the same time, there is a certain residue of sense of goodwill in the citizenry that has no vivid institutionalized form of public expression. I don't think that what the media elite think people ought to think about is necessarily what they do think about. We do not have institutions that are capable of mobilizing people's better judgment. In a sense, they're independently arrived at public opinion and turning that into an instrument of democratic self-government. So people are good at entertaining themselves with the new technologies, good at dazzling themselves. And yet I wouldn't be altogether bleak about it, because the truth is that although people don't know how to act upon what they know, there is, I think, a general awareness when people are in a serious mood. And this, I think, is true throughout the developed democracies. They do have a sense that the world is finite, that the resources are not inexhaustible, that wars and crimes against humanity are taking place, that nuclear weapons have not vanished from the planet. It's a curious mood now. I think, in a certain sense, there's a good deal of popular conventional wisdom which is on the mark, and yet the absence of political means with which to act upon, to mobilize that sentiment. I mean, people are not as foolish as they used to be. It was a radical idea, say, 30 years ago, that there were limits to the safety of dumping garbage into the atmosphere and dumping nuclear waste into the ground and so on. Well, today it's a commonplace that these are dangerous, and the debates are about what to do about it. But there's a lot less fat-headed complacency. What there isn't is a clear sense of how to act.
Meaningful information is our most precious resource. But all the information we get isn't of equal worth. It's tempting to let it all just wash over us without putting out the effort to be critical and selective. But that would mean giving up on taking actions that might help our children and grandchildren. Whenever I feel overwhelmed, I let other people inspire me. Paul Watson.
A lot of my education came through the Native American community. I was a medic at Wounded Knee, and I learned one thing from the Lakota, and that is the way of the warrior. And that is, you don't do what you do because you're going to win or you're going to lose. You do what you do because it's the only thing you can do. It's the just thing, it's the right thing to do. And you can't be concerned about the consequences. You just have to focus on doing, not on the objective. And so I think that gives a great deal of strength to know that you're doing this and to not be overwhelmed or depressed by everything around you and just keep saying, I'm doing my best. That's all I possibly can do. But I'm not a person who gets depressed easily, and I'm very, very optimistic. You know, most people accuse us of being doomsday prophets and everything else, but I'm very optimistic. I believe that we will have our salvation one way or the other. It'll either be through voluntary choices, which we make to make this a better planet and a better future, or else nature will make that decision for us by knocking us down and out of place before we can cause total damage. We'll take a lot with us, but the laws of ecology can only be violated for so long, and then Mother Nature backlashes. And the law of biodiversity, the law of interdependence, the law of finite resources, these are laws that must be obeyed or else suffer the consequences. And we've been living for hundreds of years now in total contempt of the very natural laws of ecology. And the possibility of losing biodiversity and therefore the ability of the environment to sustain us is very, very real. And in 200 years, the human species could be extinct unless we take action now and stop worrying about whether we got a new car or whether the new Roseanne show is going to come up again in the fall. I mean, we're so engrossed in trivialities that we never really get down to thinking about what is real in this world. And what is real in this world is the fact that we are part of something that is so incredibly mysterious and beautiful, and that is the evolution of life on this planet. And the world that is being shaped right now, the world that we are defining for the future, is our responsibility.